than we are because of the tariffs. And the way to think about it is that suppose you put a tariff on a product and that there's a Chinese firm and most of their sales are in the U.S., but we in the U.S. buy it from lots of different countries. Then it doesn't really affect us much to put a tariff on China, but it really affects the firms.
Although it also it raises the price of every item of that good in the United States, right? If you're buying
The point is that suppose that firm had 1% of the market in the U.S. and it was competitive to get the other 99%, then you wouldn't expect to see much of a price move. And so what we have seen are really, really big price moves for like the value of Chinese stocks that are affected by tariffs, but very, very little sign that the tariffs have had a negative effect on consumers in the U.S.
Even though consumers would be paying higher prices as this goes on and on.
Well, again, if we were to put a tariff on things where the Chinese had a really large share of the market,
you think you've been a little more selective. Okay,
we have been very selective.
Let me ask about the government shutdown. Now, is this a good time to have hundreds of thousands of people unpaid?
Well, what's going to happen, of course, is that the Congressional Research Service has told us that Congress, whenever they get around to reopening the government, they always give people their back pay. And so the way to think about it is, a huge share of government workers were planning to take the week off for the holidays, like, many of the listeners probably have done, and they were going to have to use their vacation days. But what's happening now is they're getting the day off, and they're going to get paid for those days, and they don't have to use their vacation days. Assuming the government reopens, say this week or next, then that's really the way to think about the effect.
If it's a relatively short shutdown, there would be a relatively short effect. But federal workers, if I'm not mistaken, have been given form letters to send to their landlords to try to explain why they're not paying the rent.
Well, I guess there is some evidence that when people miss a check, which haven't happened, that's not happened yet. There are definitely some government workers that have trouble meeting their bills. So the form letter, I've not seen the form letter. There are about 50 folks that work at the Council of Economic Advisors, and we didn't give them such a thing. But we did have a long email from the HR department that gave people instructions about it. But one thing I have been assuring all the people that work at our department, and I'm sure it's true across government, is that when we reopen, then they're going to get their back pay.
Of course, some people are working, the people in essential jobs, and we heard from
here I am.
There you go. And thank you for spending some of your work day with us. Really appreciate
it. It's weird,
that.
Right, that a government shutdown means I have to work more. I'm not quite sure how that happened. It's like Princess Bride. I'm not sure that word means what you think it means. Kind of, why am I going to work every day, as my wife is saying. Take some time off.
Ray Coleman Jr. is also working. He's an employee of the Federal Bureau of Prisons in Tallahassee, Florida, and president of his union local, and we spoke with him recently. Let's hear some of what he has to say.
Morale is already low. For us in the Federal Bureau of Prisons, back in January, we lost 6,000 positions. So we've already been understaffed. And now you're understaffed, as well as being required to work, not knowing when you're going to get paid.
I'll just notice, Mr. Hassett, this is a guy in the Florida Panhandle, which is very much Trump country. I don't know how this guy voted, but there's a lot of Trump voters out there. Should people in that area of the country be hurt?
Well, again, this is a relatively short-term thing, and hopefully it resolves soon. We made an extremely reasonable offer to Congress more than a week ago, and it looks like what's going on is Chuck Schumer has decided not to allow anything through the Senate. It's a final deal until Nancy Pelosi is Speaker. And so right now everybody's on hold because we're waiting for Nancy to take over.
Well, just very briefly, there was also a deal on the table in the spring, which Senator Lindsey Graham has brought up again, and that is trading some wall funding for some help for DACA recipients. Is the president likely to go for that?
I don't know what the final deal is that's going to happen, and that's, not something that CEA negotiates. But I do know that we made a very reasonable offer to them more than a week ago, and they just never got back to us. And the word that I'm hearing is that the Democrats have decided to wait until Nancy Speaker to do anything.
Kevin Hassett, thanks very much for the time. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, great to be here. Thank you.
He is chairman of the White House Council of Economic Advisors. NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley has been listening along with us. Scott, what did you hear there?
Well, I heard the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors say that the government shutdown won't have any lasting effects on the U.S. economy, and that's probably true. I think private economists agree with that if, in fact, it is resolved quickly. The longer it goes on, of course, the more those effects might pile up. He is correct that in past shutdowns, government workers have ultimately received back pay for the time they either worked without pay or were furloughed, and that really shows what a kind of a waste of this is. I mean, it's a particularly kind of brain dead policy to furlough workers and then pay them for the work that they didn't do. He is correct that the economic fallout hasn't been felt yet. The first time that government workers would have to go without a paycheck if this continues is the 11th of January. But I was out with a couple of federal workers over the weekend, and they were certainly concerned about what that was going to mean for their household budgets.
Scott, very briefly, the Democratic House takes over in a couple of days. They could quickly pass this resolution that already passed the Senate one time, 100-0, or unopposed, if I'm not mistaken. Could that just be passed again and sent to the president?
It would have to pass the Senate again, and it's not clear that the Republican-controlled Senate would pass something that they didn't think President Trump was going to sign. They might hold out till the president is able to negotiate something with the Democrats, and so far we haven't seen a breakthrough there.
Okay, we'll see what happens. Scott, thanks very much. Really appreciate it.
Good to be with you, Steve.
That is NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley.
Journalism advocacy groups are calling for the Nicaraguan government to end its attacks on the media. The government of Costa Rica has now joined in. Nicaragua's strongman president Daniel Ortega has imprisoned a television journalist who has Costa Rican citizenship. Here's reporter Maria Martin.
In the last 2 weeks, the Ortega government has intensified its repression of civil society groups and media outlets in Nicaragua, raiding several media organizations, closing one, and imprisoning journalists. This is the sound as dozens of heavily armed police brutally shoved journalist Carlos Chamorro and his staff with nightsticks and plastic shields outside police headquarters in Managua. Chamorro, director of the digital outlet Confidencial and one of the most respected journalists in Central America, had come to place an official complaint after Confidencial's offices were raided and its equipment damaged in mid-December.
En los últimos meses han ocurrido actos gravísimos de agresiones contra la libertad de prensa y la libertad de expresión.
Chamorro continues to produce programs like this one examining the embattled state of Nicaragua's media. But according to reports, he does it practically in hiding. Other media outlets have fared worse. The director of the television station 100% Noticias, 100% News, Miguel Mora, and its news director, Lucia Pineda, were kidnapped and taken into custody after the station's equipment was destroyed. They're now in the infamous El Chipote prison, charged with fomenting hate and terrorism. There's special concern about journalist Pineda, who hasn't been allowed to see her family, nor human rights representatives, nor the Costa Rican consul. Pineda holds dual Nicaraguan and Costa Rican citizenship. This weekend, Costa Rica's president, Carlos Alvarado, himself a former journalist, stated that his neighboring country is most concerned about the ever-increasing violations of human rights and press freedoms in Nicaragua. Meanwhile, international press groups such as Reporters Without Borders, the Committee to Protect Journalists, and the Inter-American Press Association are calling for President Ortega to end the escalation of attacks against media he sees as critical of his government. Ortega and his supporters maintain they support freedom of expression in Nicaragua. For NPR News, I'm Maria Martin.
This is NPR News.
Good morning. It's 8:19 on the last day of 2018. It's Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Senator Elizabeth Warren is taking the first major step toward running for president. The Massachusetts Democrat announced this morning she's forming an exploratory committee for the 2020 campaign. She's the most prominent Democrat yet to make such a move. More on that story coming up in about 15 minutes.
When you give to Wisconsin Public Radio, you have a powerful impact. You make WPR the place that hundreds of thousands of people turn to for independent news, statewide discussions, and inspiring music, as well as laughter, just when you need it. WPR is listener-supported, and that means you make a difference. So make your tax-deductible year-end gift right now at WPR.org. Thank you.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio is provided by the Lee Ester News Fellowship, providing early career journalists the opportunity to learn hands-on reporting, editing, and broadcasting in a professional setting as part of the WPR News Department.
Support for classical music on WGTD comes from Piasecki Althaus Funeral Home. The staff at Piasecki Althaus can answer your questions about pre-planning a meaningful funeral or tribute service. Piasecki Althaus, honoring and serving families in our community since 1931.
Looking at the weather forecast for today, we're expecting a wintry mix in the southern part of the state. Freezing rain in the morning is possible, and then snow later in the day. And snow is possible in central and northern Wisconsin as well. And we're expecting that snow to continue into the overnight hours, highs in the low 30s. Tomorrow, to kick off 2019, you can expect some light, lingering snow and highs in the 20s. The Green Bay and Fox Valley areas are expected to get the highest total snowfalls with around 4 to 6 inches possible.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Focus Features and Participant Media, presenting On the Basis of Sex, inspired by a true story of the young Ruth Bader Ginsburg, starring Felicity Jones and Armie Hammer, now playing in select theaters everywhere January 11th. From the William T. Grant Foundation, working to harness the power of research to make a difference in the lives of children, teens, and young adults for more than 80 years. Learn more at wtgrantfdn.org. And from Tire Rack, offering a tire decision guide to help customers find tires that fit their car and driving conditions. With a network of more than 7,000 independent installers. TireRack.com, helping drivers find, deliver, install.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Noel King.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Is coconut oil a healthy food? Certainly is promoted as one. Survey a broad group of Americans and 72% say yes, coconut oil is healthy. Talk with some nutritionists and they say no, it's not. NPR's April Fulton reports.
Let's get one thing out of the way. Fat is not the enemy. Fat helps us feel fuller longer and stay satisfied. Eating some fat can actually help us snack less and potentially lose weight. But there's something pretty important about fat to consider. What kind of fat we're eating and how much.
I'm going to saute my onions in extra virgin olive oil here.
I'm in the kitchen with Mary Donkersloot.
It's my favorite oil for sauteing.
Donkersloot is a nutritionist in Beverly Hills. She's using olive oil because it's high in monounsaturated fat.
In terms of calories, all fats are the same. Butter, coconut oil, olive oil, they all have the same number of calories. But they're different when it comes to your health.
And when it comes to health, Donkersloot is no fan of coconut oil because it has lots of saturated fat, which is associated with an increase in the risk of heart attack and stroke.
You know, a tablespoon of coconut oil has about 12 grams of saturated fat, whereas olive oil has 2. Butter comes in the middle there around 7.
So just 1 tablespoon of coconut oil contains most of the saturated fat many Americans are supposed to have in one day. That's not leaving any room for yogurt or meat. And forget dessert. Still, a lot of people think coconut oil is different.
Adding fat to your diet in this idea that it's going to bust your belly fat? No, not going to happen.
Studies just haven't borne it out. While some preliminary research shows that coconut oil raises the levels of good cholesterol, it also raises the levels of bad cholesterol. Donkersloot says there are many options.
All right, let's go check out the oils at the store.
Okay.
We drive to Jade's, a local gourmet market near her house. Here the oil aisle looks a lot like the cereal aisle with tons of choices.
Wow, this is quite a beautiful array of oils. Here's grapeseed, walnut, almond oil.
And bottles of olive oil.
How about this pumpkin seed oil? Never heard of it.
So how do you choose? First, look for the oils with the lowest amount of saturated fat. Alice Lichtenstein directs the Cardiovascular Nutrition Lab at Tufts University. She basically looks at how our diets affect our hearts. Since the 1960s, Lichtenstein says, well-controlled clinical trials have shown that too much saturated fat can be a problem.
So that would be things like coconut oil, or palm kernel oil, and then animal fats. So that would either be meat fat or dairy fat.
Those studies also show that if we replace those types of fat with unsaturated fats like corn oil, sunflower oil, or olive oil, we'll reduce our risk of cardiovascular disease and be healthier. Lichtenstein has seen a lot of fad diets come and go.
Why things like coconut oil somehow slipped under the radar is a little bit unclear, but it's not consistent with any of the recommendations that have occurred over the past 30, 40, 50 years.
So it's okay to use coconut oil, just don't use it all the time. What you want to do is shift the ratio more towards unsaturated fat and away from saturated fat. And that means more olive, flax, and canola oil, and less coconut oil and bacon. When it comes to your diet, it's all about the balance. April Fulton, NPR News, Los Angeles.
All right, the holiday season is winding down. This time of year often feels like it's all about the cute and the cuddly. Take a listen to this clip from Disney's Lady and the Tramp, in which the wife, Darling, gets a big-eyed puppy on Christmas morning.
Oh, how sweet.
You like her, Darling?
Oh, I love her.
Now, here is something interesting. When some of us encounter too much cuteness, our brains generate ugly thoughts. NPR's John Hamilton explains.
Scientists call it cute aggression. Catherine Stavropoulos is one of those scientists. She's a psychologist at the University of California, Riverside. And Stavropoulos says cute aggression is the reaction lots of people have when the adorable factor gets cranked up to 11.
It could be a cute animal or a cute baby, and they just have this flash of thinking, I want to crush it, or I want to squeeze it until it pops.
Stavropoulos says those thoughts sound worse than they are.
When people feel this way, it's with no desire to cause harm. It's just that it's so cute. They have this strange feeling, and most people feel like, I can't explain this. This is weird. I'm probably the only one who feels this way. I don't want to hurt it. I just want to eat it.
Cute aggression was first described in 2015 by researchers at Yale. But Stavropoulos wanted to know what it looked like in the brain. So she and a colleague recorded the electrical activity in the brains of 54 young adults as they looked at images of animals and people. The images included both grown-ups and babies, and Stavropoulos says some of the images had been manipulated to look either less appealing or extra adorable.
So big cheeks, big eyes, small noses, all these features that we associate with cuteness.
The study found that for the entire group of participants, cuter creatures were associated with greater activity in brain areas involved in emotion. But people who felt more cute aggression also had more activity in the brain's reward system. So Stavropoulos says people who think about squishing cute little puppies appear to be driven by two powerful forces in the brain.
It's not just reward, and it's not just emotion. It seems to be both. So both systems in the brain are involved in this kind of experience of cute aggression.
The combination can be overwhelming. And scientists say that may be why the brain starts producing aggressive thoughts. The idea is that these negative emotions help people get control of the positive ones running amok. Oriana Aragon at Clemson University was part of the Yale team that gave cute aggression its name.
It could possibly be that somehow these expressions help us to just sort of get it out and come down off that baby high a little faster.
Aragon says about half the population experiences some level of cute aggression, and she says it's often accompanied by other contradictory expressions of emotion.
So people who, you know, want to pinch the baby's cheeks and growl at the baby are also the people who are more likely to maybe cry at the wedding or cry when the baby's born, or more likely to also, you know, have nervous laughter.
Aragon says she's one of these people.
For me, puppies are just amazing and adorable and cute, and I cannot resist them.
She also says she's a sucker for cute movies. So I test her with the first cute puppy movie that comes to mind.
Lady and the Tramp.
Oh.
Well, there you go. Right?
John Hamilton, NPR News.
Too cute. Way too cute.
This is NPR News.
Journalist Jerry Mitchell has spent decades investigating unsolved civil rights era killings in the South.
It was not just these guys got away with murder, it was the fact that everybody knew they got away with murder. So this was kind of injustice at its height.
I'm Ari Shapiro. Mitchell's work has led to murder convictions in several cases police had abandoned. We'll talk with him this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical Music.
It's 8:29 now. You're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. And a news update from NPR is next. Then in the WPR newscast, the latest report on homelessness in the country show numbers largely unchanged from previous years. More on homelessness in Wisconsin in just a moment.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. The partial shutdown of the federal government is in its second week with no signs of any breakthroughs between Congress and the White House. NPR's Susan Davis says President Trump is holding firm on his demand for billions of dollars for a border wall as part of a government spending plan.
It certainly seems like the shutdown is going to continue into the new year. The question now is just how long into the new year. Incoming House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer are supposed to be negotiating with President Trump, but there's been a real breakdown in communication and no real sign that those negotiations have made any progress. What Pelosi has said is when Democrats take control on January 3rd, the first order of business for Democrats will be to pass a funding bill to reopen the government, and then we'll go from there.
Many Central American migrants who've been turned away at the U.S.-Mexico border say they have nowhere to go. As Monica Ortiz Uribe reports from El Paso, local residents and some from out of state are helping out.
The variety is extraordinary. These are low-income folks who rely on a food pantry for meals. They've volunteered to cook for the migrants. People have flown in from as far away as Maine to help out for a week or two. Then there's the college students who are on winter break. People go to Costco and fill up a cart with diapers and jackets to take to the shelters.
This is NPR News from Washington.
And this is news from Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8:31 now. I'm Hannah Haynes. Homelessness across the United States remained largely unchanged in 2018, according to the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. In Wisconsin, there were about 5,000 homeless individuals this year. HUD takes a snapshot of homelessness for its annual report to Congress. Carrie Poser directs the advocacy group Wisconsin Balance of State Continuum of Care. She's most concerned by the increase in the number of people considered chronically homeless.
People that are chronic homeless are those with a disability as well as have been homeless for a long period of time. And to increase that number is difficult because they're who we should be prioritizing our housing options for.
According to HUD, 8 in every 10,000 people experience homelessness in Wisconsin. Of those, 92% are in a shelter. The number of homicides in Milwaukee has declined for a third consecutive year. Police say that as of Sunday, 99 people were homicide victims in 2018. That's the lowest number of victims since 2014. The total doesn't include killings committed in self-defense or accidental shootings. There were 118 homicides in Milwaukee in 2017. Mayor Tom Barrett says a major initiative to reduce violence that began in November 2017 and community involvement are beginning to yield positive results. The 2018 homicide total is subject to change, though, pending the outcome of current investigations, including one on Monday on the city's south side. A man was found with a gunshot wound and died at the scene. Illinois Governor Bruce Rauner has rejected Michigan's offer of $8 million to support a project to keep invasive carp from establishing themselves in the Great Lakes. The Detroit News reports Rauner told Michigan's governor that the offer to support operations at the Brandon Roadlock and Dam near Julia, Illinois, won't be useful until after an upgrade is completed in 10 years. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has recommended adding a new electric barrier that will repel or stun Asian carp. The agency also recommended flushing jets and underwater speakers to deter the fish. The project is estimated to cost almost $780 million, while maintenance and operations may cost about $8 million a year. Rauner and Michigan Governor Rick Snyder are leaving office in the new year. You're listening to news from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, whose Clinical Scientist Development Awards support promising early year physician scientists and their research efforts to improve human health. From the Wallace Foundation, fostering improvements in learning and enrichment for disadvantaged children and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas at wallacefoundation.org. And from the William T. Grant Foundation at wtgrantfoundation.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Noelle King. Good morning. It is the last day of 2018, and one U.S. senator is announcing her plans for 2020. Elizabeth Warren, Democrat of Massachusetts, announced today that she's forming an exploratory committee for the 2020 presidential race. She made this announcement in a video that she sent to her supporters this morning.
How do we get here? Billionaires and big corporations decided they wanted more of the pie. And they enlisted politicians to cut them a fatter slice.
NPR's political correspondent Asma Khalid is with me now from Boston. Good morning, Asma.
Good morning.
So this announcement video, it's highly produced. It's not short. It seems to have a real message. What is Elizabeth Warren saying to her supporters?
Well, Noelle, in some ways, it's kind of the same message that she's been saying for a long time. You know, Elizabeth Warren has really kind of staked her career on these sort of multifactorial issues around rebuilding the middle class, regulating banks, and creating financial security for families. This is something she's been talking about when she was a law professor, something she's been writing about for a while, and something she's certainly talked a lot about whenever you listen to any of her political speeches. The video you mentioned is this kind of highly produced, four-and-a-half-minute message that was sent out to supporters this morning, and it touched on her childhood in Oklahoma and also how her mom got this minimum wage job at Sears that allowed their family to keep the family home at a point when her dad had some health issues. And so this is a message that you hear a lot, right? It was part autobiographical, telling who she was, but it also was kind of academic. She's a former Harvard law professor. And so like a true academic, there were these charts that you saw throughout the video showing the disparity between, say, white and black household wealth. You know, towards the end, she also did touch on President Trump and the need for Democrats to continue to persist. And she showed these vignette marches against the president. But really, overwhelmingly, this was a message that she was trying to present positively about rebuilding the middle class and the need for some major economic reforms.
So Warren is the first major Democratic candidate to make this kind of announcement, but she will certainly not be the last. How many more are we expecting?
That is right. I would say we can look at a couple dozen getting into the race,
wow.
Right? I mean, this is a really wide Democratic field. It's a really open contest. And it compares to, say, 4 years ago, or I shouldn't say 4 years ago, 2 years ago at this point in 2016, when Hillary Clinton jumped into the race and many people within her own party saw her as this kind of anointed front runner. There is no anointed front runner this year in the Democratic field. And so earlier this month, we saw the former Secretary of Housing and Urban Development under President Obama, Julian Castro. He's from Texas. He also announced an exploratory committee and said that he'll make a major announcement by January 12th. We also already know that John Delaney, congressman from Maryland, he's already in. He's been spending a lot of time in some early voting states. Another guy, Richard Ojeda, who ran for Congress in West Virginia and lost, has also announced he's running for president. So we're going to sort of see a number of candidates. But what makes Warren's run really interesting is, look, she's been one of the most high-profile people to consistently criticize President Trump and has tangled with him over his first 2 years in office.
And her economic message could certainly resonate depending on what the economy does in the coming year. Asma, let me ask you lastly, does this mean that Elizabeth Warren is about to spend a lot more time in the early primary and caucus states?
It certainly does. And one thing I should point out is during the midterms, Elizabeth Warren did have a number of former staffers who were stationed, say, in New Hampshire or South Carolina. And so certainly, yes, we can expect to see more of her there.
All right. It begins. NPR's political correspondent, Asma Khalid. Thanks so much, Asma.
You're welcome.
2018 was something of a banner year for the economy. The United States enjoyed healthy growth and very, very low unemployment. But the stock market is on track to finish the year with its worst performance since 2008 at the height of the Great Recession. What is happening? NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
After her parents died, Barb Egler Bailey spent a lot of time fixing up their house in Michigan. She sold it for a good price, and in September, she put some of the proceeds in a moderate-risk stock fund. The money was supposed to help fund her own retirement, but the investment has been a huge disappointment.
After the stock market here started going up and down like a roller coaster, I saw that my fund had just dropped like 20% dramatically just since this fall.
A lot of stock market investors have spent the past few weeks licking their wounds. The long bull market in stocks is ending the year more vulnerable than ever before. Quincy Crosby, chief market strategist at Prudential, says the mood in the market started to shift early in the year after a particularly strong jobs report.
It was a very good report, in fact, but we saw wages moving higher, much more than the market had expected.
That was good news for a lot of people, she said, but on Wall Street, rising wages also generated fears that corporate profits would soon be squeezed. Companies would have to pay more for workers. And Crosby says higher wages also raised the specter of inflation.
The market soon learned that any hint of inflation was going to be something that the Federal Reserve saw and that the Federal Reserve would act upon.
The Fed had already been raising interest rates for more than 2 years. Now it appeared likely it would keep doing so. The only question is by how much. In October, Fed Chairman Jerome Powell said rates were far from neutral, which is Fed speak for lots more rate increases are coming. Since then, stocks have fallen more than 20%. Then President Trump weighed in, criticizing Powell in an interview with Leslie Stahl on 60 Minutes.
Our Federal Reserve is raising rates too fast because they think our economy is too good. And I say, I don't want you to, every time we announce a good quarter, you have to raise interest rates. I don't want that. I'm very unhappy with the Federal Reserve.
The president seemed to suggest he might try to replace Powell. While investors didn't much like what the Fed was doing, they hate uncertainty even more. And Trump's words sometimes seem to be driving the market even lower. Lawrence White is a finance professor at NYU's Stern School of Business.
I think the administration has become even more erratic in both its statements and its actions.
White says the ongoing fallout from the Trump administration's aggressive trade policies have been especially harmful. The U.S. and China have been slapping tariffs on each other's imports, and there's no hint of a truce anytime soon. White says that with Democrats taking control of Congress, the dysfunction in Washington is only going to get worse.
And I think a lot of the uneasiness in the markets currently is this concern about future turbulence. I don't think it goes away for at least the next 2 years or so.
White says stocks have been doing so well for so long that a lot of people are too young to remember what a real bear market is like. For them, this is a valuable, if painful, reminder that markets can go down as well as up. Jim Zaroli, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Good morning. It's 8:42. I'm Hannah Haynes. Thanks for joining us here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, we'll look back on the year's films. NPR's Noel King talks to Claudia Puig and April Wolf of the Los Angeles Film Critics Association about their favorite films of 2018. That's in 9 minutes here on WPR.
10 years ago, Elizabeth White was doing well. She had a great job, earned good money.
And then the 2008-2009 Great Recession hit. I went from a very good income to zero.
I'm Amy Scott, underemployed, unable to retire, and facing a crisis. That's next time on Marketplace.
Thank you to the business sponsors who help support WPR programs. Businesses like Bethke Heating and Air Conditioning and the Chippewa Valley Cultural Center. Become a business sponsor. Go to WPR.org/sponsor.
Support for WGTD comes from Classic Violins, the premier southeastern Wisconsin workshop for violin family instruments. Master Luthier always on premises. ClassicViolins.com, 262-577-5488.
Bank.com.
Good morning. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Hannah Haynes in for Melissa Ingalls. Here are some of the stories we're following this morning. It's New Year's Eve. Sting, Christina Aguilera, and revelers from around the world are set to welcome 2019 in New York City's Times Square tonight. And throughout Morning Edition today, we'll look back on the year's best movies and songs. Democratic House Leader Nancy Pelosi and President Donald Trump both think they have public sentiment on their side in the battle over a border wall. That theory will be put to the test this week when the new House majority led by Pelosi gavels into session with legislation to end the government shutdown. Morning Edition is almost over today, but you can listen to All Things Considered this afternoon for updates on the day's news. That's from 4 to 6:30 today. And in weather, we're expecting a wintry mix in the southern part of the state today. Freezing rain in the morning is possible, and then snow later in the day. Snow is also possible in central and northern Wisconsin, and is expected to continue into the overnight hours. Highs in the low 30s.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Zoom. Zoom offers cloud video conferencing, online meetings, and a video conference room solution in one platform, featuring digital video and audio with screen sharing, account registration, and more at zoom.us. From Visiting Angels, professional caregivers assisting adults in bathing, dressing, meals, and light housework nationwide. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care. Office locations are at visitingangels.com. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Noel King.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. To reach the latest news about our solar system, you have to travel out to Pluto, really far from the sun, and then you travel about a billion miles more. That's what a spacecraft has done, and now it's about to get a look at a mysterious object known as a minor planet, one of thousands in the outer reaches of the solar system. The craft passes by just after midnight on New Year's. That's just after midnight Eastern time on Earth. NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce reports.
The New Horizons probe is about the size of a grand piano. It's been flying through space for over a dozen years. In 2015, it reached Pluto. What had long been just a fuzzy circle in photographs was revealed to be a stunning, dark reddish world made of frozen nitrogen and methane with ice mountains.
The exploration of Pluto that we conducted was scientifically spectacular.
Alan Stern is the principal investigator of NASA's New Horizons mission. This mission always plans to visit another icy world after speeding past Pluto. After all, it lies in a region of the solar system that's littered with thousands of small icy bodies. Stern says this upcoming flyby will be the most far-off exploration of a world that's ever been attempted.
Really, we have no idea what to expect.
It was tricky to find a minor planet that was reachable with the spacecraft's remaining fuel. But a few years ago, the Hubble Space Telescope spotted one. At a recent press conference, Stern explained that researchers know enough about this tiny world's orbit to be able to intercept it.
But there's very little else we know.
Its official name is a bunch of numbers, so it goes by the Latin nickname Ultima Thule, which means beyond the known world. This object is pretty small, only about 20 miles across. Anne Verbischer is a planetary scientist at the University of Virginia. She says by watching it pass directly in front of stars, researchers figured out that it can't be spherical. It seems oblong.
It's also red in color. We know that the surface is even redder than the surface of Pluto.
Verbischer points out that this world is 44 times farther from the sun than the Earth is, and it's been out there since the solar system formed over 4 billion years ago.
So the sun has not heated it up at all and modified its surface. It's been essentially unchanged.
That makes it a revealing relic of the solar system's early days. The New Horizons probe will fly by around 2,200 miles from its surface, snapping images with an onboard telescope and camera.
Seeing what the surface is going to look like up close is just going to be amazing.
It takes about 6 hours for the spacecraft's data to get all the way back to Earth. Detailed images from the close flyby are expected to be unveiled on January 2nd. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
Hey, thanks for listening to your public radio station, which brings you Morning Edition. You can get the latest news this afternoon on All Things Considered. And follow us anytime on social media. You can find all your Morning Edition hosts on Twitter if you'd like. I'm NPR Inskeep. There's NPR Green. That's David Green. Rachel Martin is Rachel NPR. And Noel King is Noel King. This is NPR News.
Good morning. It's 10 minutes before 9 o'clock. Thanks for tuning in to Wisconsin Public Radio today. In sports, in their last game of the season, the Packers lost to the Detroit Lions 31-0 yesterday. The UW women's basketball team plays Purdue today at 2 o'clock, and the Badgers men's basketball team will play Minnesota on Thursday night.
Support for WGTD's Radio Theater comes from the Lake Lawn Resort in Delavan, a full-service leisure getaway, family retreat, and meeting facility. Lake Lawn Resort, a proud supporter of WGTD's Radio Theater. LakeLawnResort.com.
We help you see what's going on and really understand all of it. Start your day fully awake with Morning Edition. Listen every day.
It's Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. The program is almost over for today, but stay with us. Stephanie Elkins will be in just after 9 with classical music for you. A New Year's Carol by Benjamin Britten and Little Sweet from Bach are on the way. Stay with us for that and more just after the news from NPR at the top of the hour.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Noel King. Good morning. We are heading into movie awards season. 2018 was the year of Black Panther, Crazy Rich Asians, Ryan Gosling playing Neil Armstrong in First Man. I asked the film critics April Wolfe and Claudia Puig of the LA Film Critics Association to try and pick their favorites from this year. Good morning, ladies. It's been a busy year for you both.
Oh, my God. I've written at least 4 different top 20 lists because there are two. I'm serious. I'm not even doing. And they're all different. They're all completely different. There's so many lists that could be given to you right now. And I'm sorry to give you
this
anxiety.
This has been a great year.
But I want to talk about your favorites. And I know that, Claudia, one of yours is a 1970s period piece that was set in Mexico City. It's called Roma. Tell us about that movie.
This is one of the most beautiful films. It's enthralling. It's people throw around the word masterpiece a little too lightly, but I'm going to throw it out there.
Okay.
It's such a powerful and intimate story. It's like cinematic poetry. Moments are allowed to unspool. The pacing is very different from what we normally see in American movies. And it's a portrayal of the middle class in Mexico, which is not something you see hardly ever in American films. You see, you know, of course, poor and struggling immigrants, and you see wealthy drug lords leading decadent and violent lives in luxurious haciendas, but you don't see the middle class. And it's told from the perspective of an indigenous woman who raised the director and writer, Alfonso Cuarón. And it's about the relationship between this woman and the family. She clearly loves the kids, and they love her, but she's, you know, there's definitely a class struggle here. It really resonated for me on a personal level because I lived there in the 1970s in Mexico City, and the production designer, Eugenio Caballero, was just meticulous in his production design, recreating what the streets looked like in the 70s.
Okay, I'm putting that one on my list. April Wolfe, one of your top picks of the year is First Reformed, which starred Ethan Hawke. He played a minister who was going through kind of a crisis of faith and then found purpose in environmentalism. Not to be snarky, but not exactly blockbuster material. You loved it. What did you love?
Well, I think Claudia hits on something that I was going to bring up, which is the idea of poetry. And I think that American cinema embraced the idea of poetry this year, which is a slower tone, and it's almost literary in a sense. And it's also a little bit more open. And First Reform for me hits all of those points. It's a very slow film. Paul Schrader, if he doesn't make anything after this, he doesn't need to. This could be the capstone of a really great career. And the way that Ethan Hawke acts in this film is very restrained. And it's a really beautiful thing to behold and just to kind of lean in and feel like you're getting very close to these characters.
Let's take a listen to a clip from First Reform.
Jesus didn't want our suffering.
He suffered for us. Mm-hmm.
And what of his creation? The heavens declare the glory of God. God is present everywhere in every plant, every river, every tiny insect. The whole world is a manifestation of his holy presence. I think this is an issue where the church can lead, but they say nothing.
So that's the poetry you're talking about.
Yeah, there's almost a literary quality to this. You know, the language of this is a very different film.
April, I was just wondering, I think it's Ethan Hawke's best performance. What do you think?
Absolutely. And you can see when they talk together, Paul Schrader and Ethan Hawke, the kind of respect that they have for one another and mm-hmm. the way that they talk about process is very philosophical.
Another quiet movie that made both of your lists, it's called Leave No Trace, and it's about a father and his young daughter who are living in a park outside of Portland. Let's play a clip of that.
What if the kids at school think I'm strange? Because of the way we're living?
How important are their judgments?
Guess I'll find out.
What is this movie about?
It's exploring people who are living on the margins, people that you might not ordinarily even see or think about. And that's one of the things that the director, Deborah Granik, does so well. She made A Winter's Bone, which kind of launched the career of Jennifer Lawrence. And she just has a way of drawing fantastic performances. And the two actors here, Ben Foster and Thomasin McKenzie, are just amazing as father-daughter. I completely believed that they were parent and child.
Yeah. In fact, Deborah Granik, she talks about this. She built into the budget of her movie at least a week for them, these two actors, to get together and to take a survival course. So they were actually living in the woods for a week together and bonded. And you can see that kind of familiarity in that film. And I quite love everything about this movie. And talk about literary quality, too. You know, this is... Gosh, this is a poem of a film as well. It makes you really think about things and ask Deborah Granik about her thinking about why she made it. And she'll immediately go into Henry David Thoreau and talk about stillness and the need for stillness right now.
It's interesting, the three movies that you've highlighted, it sounds like realism is part of the point in many ways. And I don't know, that's interesting to me because I guess I think about movies so much in this day and age as escapism, you know, as mm-hmm. movies about superheroes, as Black Panther, as, you know, movies about wildly wealthy people living lives, you know, most of us can't imagine, crazy rich Asians. But what impressed you this year were the movies that felt like they could really happen to people we know.
Mm-hmm. They could really happen. And I think they're also people that we maybe overlook in different ways, you know, a domestic worker, people, you know, living in a tent that we drive by perhaps, or a minister who we sort of see going about his business. We don't know what kind of interior life he's having and what struggles mm-hmm. he's having. So I think it's, you know, realism and also just delving into lives that we might not be thinking about all the time and that we're fascinated by when, you know, they're presented to us so beautifully and poetically.
Yeah. And, you know, this is a very noisy year in terms of everything else that's going on. And so to me, there is a bit of escapism in something like First Reformed mm-hmm. Roma and Leave No Trace, because you get to go into this theater and escape from the noise for just an hour or two.
Yeah, all of these films are very still and they're quiet and you have to listen and watch. And, you know, as opposed to sometimes with those big noisy films, you know, some of them are great, but some of them you almost are inured to, or you're just, you know, it's just too much. It's like overload, sensory overload. This is a much gentler, these are gentler films.
Quiet down and pay attention to people is kind of a nice message. I'm willing to take it in 2018. Film critics April Wolf and Claudia Puig of the Los Angeles Film Critics Association, thank you both.
Thank you.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Noelle King.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
You can hear Morning Edition weekdays from 5 to 9 here on Wisconsin Public Radio, and join us at 3 for more on the day's news on BBC NewsHour, followed by All Things Considered at 4 o'clock. It's a minute before 9 o'clock, and stay with us. News from NPR is up next.
Support for WPR comes from Rogers Behavioral Health, providing treatment for OCD, PTSD, and eating disorders in children, teens, and adults. Programs are at locations throughout Wisconsin. rogersbh.org.
Support for WGTD comes from Gateway Technical College. There are more jobs and opportunities out there than there are people to fill them. Gateway will prepare you for the growing job market. Life is big. Be prepared. Get started at gtc.edu.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway.